The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Happy Thursday, everybody. You're watching Squawk Box, the finest business show on this planet, I'm being told anyway. With myself, Steve Sedgwick, and Arabi Legomedia, and vast amounts of tape and brilliant interviews out of Washington, D.C. from Karen Cho. These are your headlines. ECB policymakers appear to line up behind a June rate cut, but the Bundesbank president, Joachim Nagel, tells CNBC he still has some concerns.
It's good news that inflation is coming down, so I think this is what we would like to achieve when we hike interest rates. Talking about the June meeting, I think the probability is increasing that we will see a rate cut in June, but there are still some caveats.
A Boeing whistleblower testifies on Capitol Hill, blasting his former employer for negligence and calling for the flagship Dreamliner now to be grounded.
UBS reportedly planning another round of layoffs with cuts expected in its banking, markets, as well as wealth management division. ABB raising its full-year outlook after topping first-quarter profit forecast with CEO Björn Rosengren, citing stronger-than-expected order momentum. We'll speak to the ABB boss later this hour. It's a first on CNBC.
So, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good, thank you. You well?
Good. Yeah, very well indeed. I'm just loving the fact that Karen's doing all the hard work and we're just digesting all her work in DC. And if you're wondering why Karen's not actually on the show as well, I think it's like a 1 a.m. in Washington as well. So we thought we'd just let her do this vast amount of interviews rather than having to come and join us as well. But look, absolutely fascinating. And I think we're going to move on quite soon, but we've got to wait till June to move on because first of all, we've got to get the rate cut from the ECB over the line, haven't we? And a June rate cut appears, as I think you're all aware now, increasingly to be on the cards for the ECB, with the rate debate rife at the IMF World Bank meetings in DC. Now, the Bundesbank president Joachim Nagel and the Banco de Portugal governor Mario Centeno backed a June cut in interviews with Karen. But the Austrian central bank governor, and you'll recall my interview of him from Davos, this is Robert Holzmann. He's always a bit hawkish. You'd expect that. He's an Austrian. That kind of goes with the territory. He told Karen he needs to wait until June, though, before making a decision. Well, back to the Bundesbank chief, Nagel. He told Karen that despite an expected cut in June, the outlook remains uncertain.
All what is beyond June and even for June, as I said, there are some things we have to see what are the numbers, what will the numbers tell us as a new story for our June meeting, and then we will see what does it mean for the July meeting. But frankly, speculating beyond June, this is, in my understanding, not very helpful.
So are some members of the governing council then speculating, because some are willing to commit and forecast 3 to 4 rate cuts for this year?
Yeah, I heard that, I read that, but as I said, for me it's important to think from meeting to meeting. This was a good approach for the last 2 years, and this is still my understanding how we should do monetary policy here in the Eurozone.
I understand you're sounding very cautious here around rate cuts, but I do want to bring up the prospect of a 50 basis point rate cut as a scenario, because we are seeing fading growth. There's a challenge, as some are concerned, about economic scars from here. If it turns out that the ECB is too late to cut, you didn't cut in April, if you're too late with those rate cuts, could a catch-up of 50 basis points be required at some point?
I think, first of all, we have to wait for the June meeting. I will not speculate about further rate cuts. I will not speculate about 50 basis points. I think first I would like to learn something from the new data, and then I will decide.
I admire Karen's tenacity, but asking a Bundesbank chief whether you're going to go 50 when everyone's expecting 25, I think that's a forlorn task. Meanwhile, Portugal's central bank governor, Mario Centeno, argued the case for a June rate cut, telling Karen it's about time to change monetary policy.
We need to look at the data and take all data on board.
But surely we achieved numbers for inflation that are, in my opinion, as close to 2% as we ideally would get. There's the risk of all this process becoming kind of an austerity flavor, because at some point policy may become pro-cyclical. That's the risk and the error that we in Europe have done lately with austerity policies. We need to keep short of that. We have the Stability and Growth Pact that is going to be enacted again, that will bring fiscal policy under an umbrella that is much welcome. So Europe played so far a stability role in the world, both in terms of monetary policy and of fiscal policy. We need to continue doing that. And that means, in my opinion, changing the cycle of monetary policy. So yes, we need to look ahead and month by month, meeting by meeting, decide on the path for interest rates. But it's about time to change this monetary policy cycle.
The market is looking at the potential for 4 rate cuts this year. Would you say that is even feasible at this point?
Well, I don't want to comment on markets' perspectives or the future. This is going to be meeting by meeting. All ingredients are there. There shocks that we don't see today and we don't have today. That process should continue to also give some stimulus to investment in the euro area. An economy the size of the euro area will not grow, will not increase productivity with zero growth on investment. That's not going to happen. The labor market dividend, which was huge during all this process, with increased labor supply, with firms accommodating in their margins, also shocks that they suffered. That dividend is about to expire, I will say, and we need to find different sources for stimulus for the euro area, and I'm sure monetary policy on its capacity, which is limited but still exists, can provide that.
I'll tell you what, I'm finding something fascinating. Let's take a step back. He just talked about monetary policy in an austerity policy framework. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you lot out there, but isn't austerity policy about governments that restrict financial largesse in order to rein in budget deficits? That's what I grew up thinking about it. Not central banks reining in inflation suddenly becoming an austerity policy. I know what he means when he refers to that and pro-cyclicality, but their job isn't to be austere or not. Their job is to get inflation under pressure as well. So I think it's very interesting, once again, dare I say, a Southern European central banker talking about austerity in terms of monetary policy rather than fiscal policy. I would go back at Mario, and I know the man very well. I think he's a very nice man. He's a very competent man. I'll go back and say there's nothing austere about most of the Eurozone's fiscal policies. In fact, quite the opposite. The IMF's warning that the budget deficits and the debt to GDPs built up around Europe and the globe are extreme. There's nothing austere about them as well. I don't know. I find that fascinating. What about the Austrian Central Bank governor? What does he say? Well, that's Robert Holzmann. He says he wants to wait until the results of wage talks. Well, they're ongoing, aren't they? And to see how oil prices develop. Again, one of the supply side issues that the ECB can't control. So see how the oil prices develop before committing to a June rate cut. Speaking to Karen, the ECB policymaker said events in the Middle East would play a key role in Europe's monetary policy. Yeah, they could actually be the banana skin, couldn't they?
The biggest threat is geopolitics, because we have seen what's happening in the East, and there, quite definitely, there the biggest threat is coming from. As you could imagine, only one boat sunk in the Gulf of Hormuz, and we may have a different oil price, and which of course may require us to rethink our strategy.
This event over the weekend comes just as we've had a whole bunch of data suggesting that some of the energy spikes that Europe contended with has been fading now from the inflation basket. So what would the worst case scenario be on first round effects, second round effects, if the geopolitics worsen? There are implications on oil and shipping.
Well, The most important is on energy. As I may recall, Europe is highly energy dependent. US is an exporter, so the US would profit. Europe again lose out of it. And then oil price going up there would be a major, major shock. But it's not the only one. The other one is, of course, then more disturbance about things sent out from Asia and arriving late and with higher prices in Europe, but also a second area of pricing.
Again, fascinating nuggets of information extrapolated there from Karen's interviews. Let me just make this a bit more 3D. Holtzman talking about the risks of energy, Middle East spikes inspired, what have you, any kind of supply side issues, and it is having an effect already. Look at this. This is from the AAA in the United States. So we'll park Europe there for the moment. Gasoline prices continued to move higher so far in April by 4.3% from the March average, after gains of 7% and 4.6% in the previous month. Sooner or later, a 4.6, a 7% and a 4.3% figure on gasoline will come through into inflation. It could potentially have second round effects as well. As people look at the higher prices, say, I need higher wages as well. Yeah. So very, very interesting that a European policymaker, who is, albeit on the hawkish side, is talking about the effects of energy rather than the stuff that they can particularly control. Because as we all know in Europe as well, we import vast quantities, dare I say it, still importing a large amount of product from the Russians still. But they don't like to talk about LNG, do they? Moving on, Croatian National Bank Governor and ECB Governing Council member Boris Vucic addressed possible divergence with, it's not possible, it's going to happen, isn't it? I think we all think now that there is going to be divergence with the Fed. Anyway, telling CNBC that Europe's monetary policy will not be contingent on what the Federal Reserve does.
We will run our policy independently of the Fed. We will look at our set of data, and there are obvious divergences between the US and Europe since the start of the inflation cycle, not only now. So whatever the Fed chooses will not determine what our choice is. We will have to really focus on the European data when we decide when to start to cut and how much we will cut.
And Arabella and I are just going to put our feet up for another day. Actually, it doesn't say that. It's a Karen is set to have another busy day in Washington, speaking to a range of policymakers and government officials, including the German finance minister, Christian Lindner. We'll bring you all those interviews throughout the day. Let's move on. The Fed's latest beige book pointed to slight expansion in the US economic activity in recent weeks, with companies now expecting inflation pressures to hold steady. In its latest survey, the central bank said half of its districts still noted, here we go, this is exactly that point I made with Holtzman, half of its districts still noted increases in energy prices, with companies struggling, I think it says struggling, it's a strange spelling, struggling to pass cost increases on to consumers. The report comes just a day after Fed Chair Jerome Powell said monetary policy needed to remain restrictive for longer due to persistent inflation. So monetary policy needs to be restrictive for longer in the United States, yep, but not in Europe. How poor an indictment is that on our economic growth side of things?
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to touch a little bit more on that beige book as well, actually, just overall. Yeah. Some of the key factors, we keep speaking about how the U.S. economy is driven a lot by consumer spending, right?
Well, and just that's parts, what the Guard said yesterday,
well,
to
exactly.
Sarah Eisen, isn't it?
True, exactly. So listen to the parts of the beige book that then come out yesterday. Consumer spending. Minimal overall increase in consumer spending is pretty much what comes out of it, right?
Interesting.
So there is still an increase, right? Despite the difficulties, despite the higher interest rate environment you're seeing there, it's still not breaking. On the other side, they talk about discretionary spending weakness, though. So that is the only one where they're seeing weakness in discretionary spending due to high price sensitivity among consumers. There seems to be a slight divergence in what is actually happening and where that spend then is going, and if there's still money
because
saved up.
Because their shelter costs have gone up, their yep. healthcare costs have gone up, their insurance costs have gone up as well. So I think you make a fantastic point that it's on staples and the things they have to spend, and something has to give somewhere if the American balance sheet is challenged.
Yeah, well,
spot on.
More challenges,
markets?
More challenges for the market, right? Actually, that's pretty much what we saw in yesterday's picture, really, across the board. A whole lot of losses then as well. And if you take a look at the NASDAQ composite being the one that saw the biggest declines of 1.1%, that means that it's tech stocks, right? And those were the big decliners yesterday. The darling, the AI darling of the index then as well, being Nvidia. Well, that got hit yesterday. More than 4% down by the close of the trading picture yesterday. You still also had some of the other tech counters, Netflix, Meta, Apple, Microsoft, all of those were also on the decline then yesterday. And a 200-point decline overall for the NASDAQ composite. But it was another fourth day then of losses, in fact, for both the S&P and the NASDAQ, the Dow backing off from yesterday's uptick then that we had seen as well yesterday. U.S. jobless claims data is also on the deck then today, so we'll be looking at that. Plus, of course, we're still in earnings cycle. Believe it or not, we're still looking at the earnings news, and that's going to ramp up quite significantly. On the Treasuries front, of course, these have been moving a whole lot higher. Then we had seen the two-year even hit 5%. Then that's drawn down just ever so slightly. But the commentary still remains the same then. The likes of Loretta Mester still pointing towards holding off on hiking, or rather on perhaps cutting rates even later on in the year. September, of course, is still the presumed timeline with regards to some of those cuts. But again, as June did change, so too could September as well. On to the dollar crosses then. The dollar took a breather, investors stepping back to assess that interest rate outlook. In fact, then more comments from Fed officials almost cementing some of the expectations then that we could hold off on those rate cuts, at least for the time being. The yuan also stabilizing then as well in today's trading picture. You can see some stability on that front. Even dollar yen pretty much sitting flat so far this morning. 154 still the mark, but have we moved the goalpost to 155 as being that intervention mark? We just seem to continuously move that intervention mark then as well. Pretty much stable as well for euro dollar. Onto the Asian market picture then. The market here is in contrast to Wall Street's decline in yesterday, actually. So we've seen gains on this front, 0.8% higher for the Hang Seng. It's actually the airline stocks that seem to have been on the up as oil prices sank around 3% then as well yesterday. So we'll touch on that just a little bit. But the Shanghai composite up 0.5%, Steve.
I think we're learning a lesson now, and we're beginning to see it, and we must keep asking all our guests this, is what is the leadership looking like in the United States if Nvidia and Tesla and Apple and Microsoft and Salesforce and Google are finding themselves under a lot of pressure? Fascinating part of the market story we're in now as well, especially for those tech names. Okay, coming up on the show, talking about tech names, one of the most important companies, I think arguably the most important company in the world geopolitically, is TSMC. It's poised to release its latest numbers. We'll break them down when they cross. Plus, we'll give you more coverage from the IMF spring meetings as policymakers give their own take on what's next for inflation rates and earnings season continues in Europe. We'll be joined by the CEO of Nokia later. Tune into that. Pekka Lundmark will join us, 9:45 Central European Time.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters, and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Welcome back. Now, Tesla shareholders will be asked to vote on Elon Musk's $56 billion pay package once again. That's after a Delaware court voided the compensation deal earlier this year. In a proxy filing, the company also said it intends to call a vote on moving its state of incorporation to Texas from Delaware. Now, the carmaker's annual meeting is scheduled to convene in mid-June. What a story.
What a story. Now, look, I know there are nuances and subtleties and there's a more pragmatic approach on this. And the binary approach I'm about to say, it is not all of the story. And I want my caveat to be, I have a lot of respect for Elon Musk. I think he is one of the most extraordinary human beings of our generation, of this business generation.
I think everybody can write down your caveat on Elon Musk every time.
So let me get this right. Man whose shares, whose company has gone from $400 a share to $155 a share. A company that's gone X growth in key markets in China. A company that is really, really struggling to prove why it's worth 55 times forward PE compared with its rivals, which trade at single digit PEs, has decided to change where the company has its jurisdiction from Delaware to Texas because it doesn't like what a Delaware court said about a $56 billion pay deal.
Yeah. He would say, and I think he would. He could go on and say,
go on, you,
I currently,
you channel I'm just... your inner Elon as well. By the way, again, I think he's yeah. amazing.
Oh,
I just 100%. Don't know if he's worth $56 billion with that as a backdrop.
Look,
extra. $56 billion extra.
He will say, the reason we might, I could say, I currently own 13%. I want this 25% so I can build AI into this company.
Why can't he build AI into the company with his current pay deal?
Oh, I don't know. He'll just say, why?
But if he owns 13%,
why am I building that wealth for other people?
If he owns 13% of the company, which he does, and he has paid a vast amount of money as the CEO, which he is, yeah. and he's one of the world's richest men, albeit not the richest man at the moment, I presume if Tesla nails AI, he will be a major beneficiary
anyway.
Oh, he would be
absolutely, 100%.
So why don't we give him options at $350 then, or $400, or $500, or wherever Kathy Wood thinks it's going to be next, $700,000. If it's going to be such a slam dunk that if he is allowed to invest within the Tesla bracket, his AI aspiration, rather than saying I'll go off and do it outside, then why does he get share options at higher strike prices rather than giving him $56 billion?
I fully agree with you, because this is also a man who actually sold off some of these shares. Right? I mean, remember for the purchase of Twitter?
So you sell shares and get given more because you've sold your shares?
I mean, yeah.
I want that deal. Or something with a couple of noughts knocked off. Many noughts knocked off. I want my Comcast version of that. I'd like Comcast shares to move up as well, but that's another hope. Eventually. US President Joe Biden has called for tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminium to be more than tripled. Wow. As he seeks to please steel workers in the swing state of Pennsylvania. I haven't got an election coming up, have we? Oh, yeah. The products targeted currently face levies of up to 7.5% under legislation introduced under his predecessor, Mr. Trump. Elsewhere, U.S. Steel reaffirmed its commitment to Nippon Steel in the wake of Biden's comments, promising that plants will not close and jobs will be protected. The company also posted its support for Biden's proposal on X, saying it applauded the enforcement of fair trade against China.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.